There's an election coming up, remember that? The way political campaigns are run today is much different than they were just a few decades ago, and even a few election cycles ago. A new empirical, data-driven approach to winning elections is beginning to be put in place, and this new methodology is methodologically cataloged in Slate columnist Sasha Eisenberg's new book called The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased to welcome Sasha to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
There's been a scientific revolution in campaigns in recent years. You note that the research being conducted on voters today is similar to drug trials?
Yeah, there's been this sort of movement towards doing randomized experiments inside campaigns, starting in academia and political science in the late 90s. People started testing the effectiveness of all the things that campaigns spend time and money on. And in the same way that you can randomly assign voters to get, you can randomly assign patients to get doses of medication or placebos, academics and people inside campaigns, including Obama's, are sort of randomly assigning doses of political communication. And so these are basically drug trials, but voters are the guinea pigs.
And what kinds of placebos are being applied?
Well, so what we get is you sort of have, you know, control group trials. And so the first test that two guys from Yale ran in 1998, which ended up being really revolutionary in the way campaigns are run, is they just randomly assign voters to get several different types of get-out-the-vote reminders, one by mail, one by phone, one by a knock at the door. And then you can see which one actually does a better job of turning people out to vote. And in the political world, which had long sort of relied on people to sort of tell competing stories about why they won an election. You know, I mean, we're gonna encounter this next week, right? So something's gonna happen on Tuesday, and then everybody will try to explain it. And there, for many things that happen in campaigns, there will be no way to sort of assess who is right and who is wrong. So, you know, we're already sort of getting intimations that Republicans are saying if they lose, they'll blame the storm. Well, how do we know that? We still don't really know how the big things happen, but these tests are making campaigns a lot smarter about understanding the influence of a lot of little things.
Well, you're talking to us from Columbus, Ohio. Won't that be the thing that is given most often as an explanation how the vote went in Ohio?
Right, but the vote how the vote goes in Ohio is several million things, and so I think that there was long an instinct among both journalists and political professionals to try to reduce campaigns to sort of one big thing at a time. It was all about a charismatic candidate, or all about the moment, or all about an issue, or a state, and these experiments I think have helped campaigns to sort of disaggregate individual voter psychologies and understand that there are little things that you can do to change somebody's likelihood of voting. That has to do with increasing their likelihood of turning out, not necessarily changing who they vote for, but that you can add up all of these sort of little interactions with voters, and that's having an impact on the sort of architecture of a race, even if you can't reduce it to saying it was about Florida or it was about the economy or it was about people being fatigued with Bush.
And the categories seem to change. We no longer hear much about soccer moms, but that was something we heard a lot about in previous elections.
Yeah, so there's been, at the same time that these experiments have taken hold in campaigns, there's been all this new data that's sort of come into the campaign world since 2000, basically. And what's happened is it used to be that campaigns were basically limited in how they could think of voters. Either they had to categorize you by the sort of big demographic categories that are on your registration record, your age, your gender, in some places, race or ethnicity, or the sort of geographies in which you lived, your precinct or district or the census tract. And that meant that campaigns often limited voters to very broad categories. What's happened since then is that campaigns have gotten access to all this information that's been collected by corporate America that are in commercial marketers' databases that were first developed for uses for develop credit rating scores and then being used by direct mail marketers. And now they run these sophisticated statistical algorithms. This is what people call micro-targeting. That they'll come out with an individual level probability that you will vote, or that you will vote for Barack Obama, or that you will be pro-choice, sort of whatever the issues they care about. And what it allows them to do is to sort of regroup voters not by just those sort of demographic categories or their geographies, but sort of group voters together by their political attributes or their predicted political attitudes. And what it means is that you might have a campaign will assign the same prescription, the same set of individualized contacts over the phone or mail or knocks at the door to two voters who don't look outwardly alike. One could be a 25-year-old Latina woman who lives in a rural precinct, and one could be a 57-year-old white guy who lives in a downtown condo. But the campaign might say, oh, we think you both have a 67% likelihood of voting for Mitt Romney, and we think that you're both 54% likely to turn out and cast a ballot on Tuesday. So we will interact with you the same way, even if we couldn't put a neat category on it, like soccer moms, or you're from the same swing district. And so what campaigns are doing there is starting to think about people very much as individuals with unique attributes, and then sort of redrawing the geography based on people who act alike, not just people who look similar.
One Republican analyst you spoke with called the rivalry between the two parties an information arms race. Do they have different approaches? As I understand it, the Republicans have used consumer reports from private companies, which detail the purchasing behavior of nearly every American. And the Obama campaign has a micro-targeting system that predicts the preference of every voter in the country. Are they pretty much working toward the same end?
They're working towards the same goal. They want to answer the same question, which is they want to improve their ability to sort through voters. I mean, they have to do something that most corporations never have to do, which is to think about the individual preferences of 170 million potential consumers at one time, and are trying to get them all to do something on, I guess early voting changed a little, but to do basically all the same thing on the same day. And so the idea is to develop the best tools possible to sort through voters to know whom you should engage, how, and when. I think that there are not that they went out to do this differently, but that each side has sort of been drawn to different areas for insights. And I think Republicans had a significant advantage in sort of the first part of the last decade, from 2000 to around 2005 or 6. And we sort of heard a lot about George W. Bush's successes micro-targeting in his reelection. And that's because they were the first ones to sort of fully link up with the way that the corporate world marketed to its consumers and understood how to sort of mine data that had been collected for commercial purposes, connect it to sort of political voter files, and then use it to segment voters. The biggest gains in the last 5 or 6 years have been coming from the social sciences, from academia, running these experiments, which are methodologically complex, and analysis is not something that comes naturally to political professionals. And there you see that Democrats and the left more broadly have really benefited from closer ties with academic researchers in political science and behavioral psychology and economics who are very interested in solving this problem that the political world has wrestled with, which is sort of how do we explain cause and effect? How do we isolate the individual impact of a knock on the door or a given message or a piece of mail that's talking about Bain Capital and understand whether that's really moving somebody and sort of separate it from all the other fog of that campaign? And that's a place where the Obama campaign has developed, I think, a significant methodological edge over Romney.
And the Republicans, you think, are misguided in using consumer reports from private companies that detail our purchasing behavior? What did they think purchasing behavior would reveal about our political tendencies?
Yeah, so the Obama campaign and the Democrats buy plenty of consumer data, too, and are very sophisticated at using it. I just think there are fewer gains in 2012. I think in many respects, the most advanced political marketers are now ahead of corporate marketers. What they do is they'll go out and they'll buy hundreds of variables that are available about you. And a lot of this is stuff that you sort of give away, maybe unwittingly, when you fill out a customer service questionnaire or a warranty and you basically give up good demographic information about yourself. So you check off the box that says that you have a college degree and you have a household income of $75,000 to $100,000 and you have two children and you took three vacations this year. And these companies will also go out and they'll buy magazine subscriptions and they'll buy lists of people who bought outboard motors, and they'll go out and gather local sort of sources of government data like hunting licenses or people who apply for permits to build a pool. And campaigns will add that to all the information they have from your voter registration record, what they know about your precinct or your census tract, and then all the sort of human intelligence that they gather when people knock on your door, call you during dinner, and ask you if you plan to vote, who you plan to vote for, and the issues you care about. And what these statistical models are basically algorithms that sort of trawl through maybe that 1,000 pieces of information they have about every voter and look for patterns between that and what they're finding in their polls. And these are not just the polls we're seeing every hour with the 700, 800-person samples, but massive polls, thousands of people in the state. And the algorithms can weigh the individual influence that each of those variables has on predicting the answer to the questions they really care about. How likely are you to vote, and who are you likely to vote for?
And am I likely to be in a database? Are we all?
Yes. And so, you know, there's more coverage for these consumer databases because they have information basically on everybody over the age of 18. Traditional political databases have just had people who are registered. And so one of the things campaigns have now actually been able to do is even if you're not registered, if you didn't even exist sort of in traditional political terms, campaigns could go out and get information about you and start to develop predictions about what your political behaviors would be like and then decide if they wanted to go out and find you and register you, often by mail. And so what they often find when they run these algorithms is that a lot of the commercial variables are of no use in politics. So, you know, the car you drive, it just often isn't that predictive, or it's not predictive in any way.
But what about that outdoor motor you mentioned, or the fact that you're a gun owner? Aren't they pretty predictive?
And those often are. And so what will happen is the algorithm will end up determining which of those are making a useful contribution to the thing that the campaign wants to predict. And then they can turn it into this individual level prediction of how likely you are to do what they want. And what they've ended up, the sort of end product isn't just did you buy an outboard motor or do you have a gun permit, but it comes up with this prediction that sort of you're 67% likely to vote for Mitt Romney prediction, and that becomes the currency. And that in many ways is like a credit rating score for politics. And so in much the same way that a loan officer at a financial institution will not sign off on a line of credit for you until they have a quantitative prediction of your likelihood of defaulting on a loan or paying off your bill on time or running up $1,000 in charges, a campaign is not going to send you mail or have somebody call you or knock on your door until they have a quantitative prediction of your likelihood of already supporting their candidate, of going out to vote altogether, of being pro-choice or being a gun owner. And that is the way that they sort of sort through the electorate now. And so the consumer variables, the stuff you buy, is making a contribution to that. The most valuable stuff that's coming out of those commercial databases is stuff that we tell companies about ourselves, about how much money we make, about our education, about our race or ethnicity, about how we live our lives. That's often much better than just looking at your block on the census and trying to extrapolate what your household is like or what your socioeconomic status is.
I'm talking with Sasha Eisenberg, who's a columnist for Slate and the Washington correspondent for Monocle. He covered the 2008 election as a national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. His new book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, it is published by Crown. So all of this kind of reveals how I'm likely to vote. Is any of this intent on changing my mind?
Well, yes. And so if campaigns predict you as being in an area where, in essence, they can't confidently assume who you're going to vote for, what they want to do is they want to have somebody go and have a real conversation with you and ask you how you plan to vote. And then they can determine whether you are what they call a persuasion target, one of the people whose minds they want to change, or if you're sort of a soft Romney supporter, the Obama campaign might think that they can get you to defect, or the Romney campaign may want to sort of shore up your support. But what we've seen is both of these innovations, the experiments and the micro-targeting stuff, has really taken hold since 2000, and I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, what we've seen since 2000 is we've understood how fully polarized our politics has become in partisan and ideological terms. And so there are just far fewer voters who are actually persuadable by either side. And this is something we see in the polls. You know, maybe there are 6 or 7% who are showing up as undecided. Maybe there are another few points on either side that are soft enough that they can move one way or the other. But campaigns are far more focused on identifying people who are already sort of on their side, who like their candidate, who are broadly attached to their party or coalition, but just aren't regular voters. It's just not something they regularly do.
So this is about getting people to actually go to the polls and vote, or to vote early, or whatever the system is in their area.
Exactly. And so these are the people the campaigns call turnout targets. We're pretty sure we know who you're going to vote for us, but we know that we need to do some work to turn you into a voter. And this is where most of the game is in campaigns these days. I think that media coverage ridiculously overemphasizes the extent to which campaigns are focused on changing people's minds or getting supporters of the other side to defect. There's just not that much room there. And so the campaigns have gotten much smarter about figuring out not just who the people are that they ought to mobilize, but through these experiments, understanding exactly what types of interactions you can have with a voter that makes them more likely to actually show up and cast the ballot.
If this is so effective, then why? I was also in Columbus, Ohio this last weekend. Why were there so many commercials for different political candidates, all designed to make me think that if I voted for them, for the opponent, it would be about the worst thing I could do to the future of America?
Because there's a lot of money that's going into campaigns and parties and super PACs, and television ads are the easiest way to spend it.
So that's just a matter of spending the money? Isn't this what you're talking about also costing a lot of money?
It does cost money. It takes more time, though. You know, and ultimately, almost everything we know from these experiments points to the fact that the best way to mobilize a voter is to have a volunteer from their community knock on their door and have a meaningful interaction with them. So there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of these field experiments. And what we see time after time is that volunteer contact is more effective than a paid canvasser or caller, that having somebody knock on a door is better than having them call. And then what campaigns call chatty scripts, which are you have the person at the phone bank or at the door, is led to have an interaction with the real back and forth with the voter instead of just what they call robotic scripts where I read at you for 45 seconds, has more of an impact. And so everything is pointing to the idea that there are things that we can quantify, and campaigns will now quantify them down to the penny per net additional vote that can they can deliver people to the polls that cannot be replicated with TV ads. And so but the thing is that delivery device takes time and work, and you actually need people who want to volunteer for you. And so, what we've seen in the last decade is there have been, a number of campaigns, I think like the Dean campaign in 2003, the Bush re-election in 2004, Obama in 2008, probably this Obama campaign again, we'll see the same way, that have had this sort of flowering of volunteer activity, a real focus on sort of person-to-person contact. And part of the reason, not just that these are like really charismatic candidates that people wanted to share their time with, but that the campaigns may have understood because of this new research and these tools that they had for targeting voters, that there's a real unique value in developing a place where this type of politicking could take place, and they open the offices and they hire the field organizers and train them and train the volunteers. And that's something that if you are a super PAC and you have three people in an office suite who fall into $10 million, you're never going to try to build. And if you're a campaign that only has 3 or 6 months to get going, you're never going to replicate that to the extent that a campaign that has years to do it will. If you're in a place where there's not a good party organization that has the offices and has the staff and has the sort of local knowledge, it's going to be a lot harder to sort of get that going from zero. And so, yet there's tons of money in the system, and a lot of the money in the system chases this, very small sliver of persuadable voters, just because often that's the easiest way to spend it. It's a lot easier to sort of ramp up, to scale up your TV ads. You just write a check that's twice as big to the local TV station. To scale up a sort of grassroots door-knocking operation, you need to find twice as many people who are enthusiastic about volunteering for your candidate, and that doesn't come as easily.
So what you're really saying here is that everything old is new again, that all the other things that have developed over the years are not as effective as the grassroots approach, which is the way politics was done since the beginning of this country.
It was, and then in many ways, I think, sort of fell by the wayside when people became so enthralled with television, starting in the 70s. And I think many people in campaigns lost sight of the value of those interactions once they saw that you could use mass media, paid mass media, to communicate with voters. Well, I mean, we're seeing this total resurgence in what seem like very old-timey ways of interacting with voters, not because people are so nostalgic, but because they're now actually the empirical tools to measure the effectiveness of different types of interactions. And what we see is this is the stuff that actually works.
But there is a
difference. It makes sense, which is that, these are meaningful interactions that would cut through the sort of noise of wall-to-wall TV ads like there are here in Ohio, and actually develop a more meaningful trigger to drive somebody to change their behavior.
But, Sasha, a big difference is in the old days, the alderman may have known you personally and had a sense of where you stood politically. But now they're actually looking into our personal records. Are there any privacy concerns that we should have about all of this?
I think people should be aware of who has access to their data. I mean, I think... I think it's a totally reasonable concern. Much of what companies have is stuff that we share with them in some form or another. The thing that's changed, I think, is sort of the control. Those aldermen or those precinct workers had to sort of memorize their human intelligence, and so it made parties very influential. This stuff being in databases allows campaigns that don't necessarily have a permanent centralized power structure, though, to develop sort of knowledge. And campaigns always have the interest of knowing more about you so that they can talk to you about things that they care about or that you care about, or to develop a more meaningful interaction with you. And so what's happening in many ways is that campaigns are just able to automate the type of assumptions that the alderman would have made sort of ad hoc about the people he already knows. And now campaigns can try to come as close as they can to replicating those types of meaningful interactions with voters that they don't know yet. In the end, I think it's a totally sort of heartening set of changes to our politics. It, in many ways, has humanized presidential campaigns that had gotten really warped by.
So we won't be seeing Willie Horton ads anymore
on television.
We won't be seeing things like the Willie Horton ad anymore. Well,
no,
we will
we'll
be seeing.
We'll
them.
Still see the Willie Horton ad, but I think the smartest people in campaigns will know that the impact of a Willie Horton ad will ultimately be a lot more limited than they probably thought it was 25 years ago.
We have very little time, but whoever uses data the best is the one who'll win.
No, good candidates still matter. Good bad economy still matters. Parties that people agree with still matter. But the candidate that uses data and understands the findings from these experiments most efficiently will probably be the one who's most likely to squeeze 1 or 2% more out of their existing
coalition. Sasha Eisenberg's book is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. It's published by Crown. Sasha, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Leonard. Appreciate it.